Today, the writer Malcolm Gladwell looks at the situations where misunderstanding a stranger can have catastrophic consequences, and the view from Brussels of a chaotic week in British politics. When you meet someone for the first time, how do you decide what kind of person they are? How do we tell a kind-hearted stranger from a dangerous criminal?
You could plausibly assume that after a couple of million years, human beings should be pretty good at making sense of people they aren't familiar with. Turns out we're terrible at it, and we don't seem to be very good at learning why we're terrible at it.
Malcolm Gladwell is many things, a writer for The New Yorker, the host of a hit podcast, and the author of 5 best-selling books. He weaves news events, anecdotes, and scientific studies to understand why we behave in the way that we do.
All of my books have circled around very kind of intimate and prosaic questions of human communication, human perception, human judgment, and trying to sort of extract from those encounters some lessons and some organizing principles.
Now he's turning his attention to the way we interact with strangers. From the police officer and the driver they've just pulled over, to the judge and the defendant standing before them, Gladwell wants to find out why coming into contact with people who have different perspectives and backgrounds to us can sometimes end in disaster. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, Malcolm Gladwell on the extreme consequences of misreading a stranger. I was thinking actually on my way here that the premise of your book, Talking to Strangers, is kind of an ideal one for interviews like this, with me, a stranger, talking to you, who's a stranger to me, and I'm a stranger to you.
It is, yeah. It's a little microcosm of the problem that the book tries to explore.
So is this interview going to perhaps support some of the theories that you talk about in your book that I will fail?
Is it going to go off the rails like so many of the stories I tell? I doubt it. But, I mean, we're not classic strangers.
That's true.
So we're members of the same profession. Mm-hmm. You have read things that I have written, I'm imagining. So it's not as dire a stranger encounter as the ones that I'm most preoccupied with in Talking to Strangers.
Why did you want to write Talking to Strangers? What was it that made you want to write this book?
In the summer of 2015, there was this infamous, notorious incident in America. It came at a time when a series of encounters between police and civilians, principally African-American civilians, made big news. And one of the major cases that summer was a case involving a young woman named Sandra Bland.
Out of the car, now!
Why am I being apprehended?
Who was pulled over by the side of the road in Texas by a police officer for a routine traffic infraction. She got into an argument with the police officer, was forcibly removed from her car.
Get out of the car!
And then you're going to stun me?
I will light you up! Get out!
Wow.
Now!
Wow.
Get out of the car!
Put in prison and committed suicide 3 days later.
Right, yeah.
There were a wave of cases, probably 20 cases in this two-year span, which made major headlines in the U.S. To my mind, this was in some ways the most disturbing. And I sort of became obsessed with that case. And then I realized after a while that that case was the perfect framing device for this thing I was interested in, encounters between strangers. And what are the things that cause them to go wrong? Why do they go wrong? Why aren't we good at that?
So the book is about, as you say, this conundrum that we all have to interact with strangers in the world, as much as many of us sometimes don't like doing it. But we all have to, and we think we're reading people. We think we understand what people mean, even when they say things. Like, you know, even you and I talking now, we think we could be understanding each other, but we often could be misreading it completely.
Yes. So there's a chapter devoted to the Amanda Knox story.
Good evening from Perugia, Italy, where tonight an American college student has been found guilty of murder. It was a stunning verdict in what's been called Italy's trial of the century.
Amanda!
Amanda Knox was led into this packed medieval courtroom to hear the judge pronounce her verdict.
Per quanto riguarda Amanda Knox,
Amanda and her former boyfriend, Raffaele Sollecito, guilty of the murder of 21-year-old Meredith Kircher. Amanda was sentenced to 26 years in prison.
And the question is, why did the Italian police so profoundly misread Amanda Knox. You know, Amanda Knox, I think I can say with 99% certainty, did not kill Meredith Kircher. That was a fantasy constructed by the Italian police and egged on by the British tabloid press. And in retrospect, it's absurd to think she did. I mean, really not a shred of evidence to support it. I mean, I could go through chapter and verse about what a miscarriage of justice that was. This woman went to jail for no particularly good reason. Why? Why were we so convinced that she was guilty? What happened there is that strangers drew inferences from her behavior about her interstates, about her guilt and innocence, about her motivations.
So people who don't remember with the after the murder happened,
yes,
her sort of every mood was analyzed, wasn't it? What was it that people saw that you think made them think she was guilty?
They seized on elements of her behavior that seemed inconsistent with an innocent person grieving for her dead roommate.
Who kisses in front of a murder scene? Who does gymnastics in front of investigators? Giggles when their girlfriend lay murdered? Amanda Knox did. Her character already in question, Knox was spotted at a boutique kissing Solecito and purchasing underwear the press dubbed saucy. Her image as Foxy Knoxy was now
so
solidified.
Friends of Meredith Kircher thought that Amanda Knox was distant and cold. The police officers thought that her behavior was insufficiently emotional, or that she would periodically do things that seemed completely inconsistent with the gravity of the situation. When she was putting on the plastic booties as they were walking her through the crime scene, she slipped them on her feet and did a little jig and said, ta-da! She was spotted buying underwear, red underwear, the day after the murder and kissing her boyfriend. I mean, there was a long list of these things.
And in the Amanda Knox case, it is incredible that a young and innocent girl was portrayed and was found guilty to be a murderer in a sort of a sex game, as it was said at the time. And you say that's because her actions fitted a code of what people thought was guilt. Is it also that the police needed somebody to be guilty and she was there, she was in that situation and she was naive?
Yes, but I don't think those two things are inconsistent. Police always need a culprit, a suspect, and what her behavior provided them with was a narrative to explain why they believed that she was a suspect. So what you really need is a narrative. And I think that's true of all of us when we're making sense of strangers and we make these kinds of fundamental errors, is that we do search for some kind of plausible narrative to explain their behavior. I'm spending a lot of time with the theories of a guy named Tim Levine, who's a really brilliant American psychologist who has really kind of fundamentally reimagined ideas around, particularly around deception. But Levine has this whole notion about matched versus mismatched people. And a matched person is someone whose outward behavior and demeanor matches their inner emotional states. These are people whose jaws drop when they are surprised, who smile broadly when they're happy, who avert their eyes when they tell a lie, who sweat when they're nervous, you know. But
they do what we think people do when
yes,
they're feeling
exactly
those things, yeah.
But it turns out that only a small fraction of people actually reliably behave in that way. There was a wonderful study that I talk about in the book. A group of German psychologists tried to set up a situation in which they would maximize the chances that the people involved in the experiment were surprised. So they brought somebody in down a long corridor to a room, had them read some passage from Kafka, answer questions. And then after they were done, they were led out of the room. Unbeknownst to them, while they were answering questions about Kafka, the corridor that they had come down to enter the room was transformed. It just had partitions. As the partitions were removed, it was now revealed to be a large room painted a bright red, I think is the color. They had recruited one of the best friends of the subjects to sit in a chair in the middle of the room with a single light bulb over their head, staring kind of menacingly at the door. If there's ever a situation designed to engineer surprise, it's that, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, that would be pretty surprising.
That would be pretty surprising.
I'd be pretty surprised.
So then they train a camera on a subject and they say, okay. So they're almost certainly going to be surprised. And they asked them actually after the fact, were you surprised? And everyone said, oh my God, I was unbelievably surprised. So they said, okay, so how did these people look when they were surprised? Did their jaws drop? Did their eyes go wide? Did their eyebrows raise? Did they stiffen in shock? Did they do all the things we associate with surprise and shock? And the answer is almost none of them did. Their reactions were completely inconsistent with our stereotypical notions of what surprise looked like. Some people just stared. Some people looked totally normal. That is how human beings really behave. So if you're in the business of trying to make profound inferences about someone's internal emotional states from your observations about the way they look and behave, you're going to make a lot of mistakes.
I think one of the examples I found really interesting in the book around this was you talked about judges working in New York, having to process a lot of cases a day for criminals coming in for crimes they'd just committed and having to make a decision based on not very much information, but mainly seeing them there in the court, you know, looking them in the eye. And actually, it turns out that perhaps being able to see them was clouding their judgment.
Yeah, so these are bail hearings. We have a suspect who just committed a crime. So the judge has to decide, do I release the suspect and have them come back when their trial is set? Or do I put them in jail because I really worry they'll commit another crime or run away? And there was a really fascinating experiment done by a group of computer scientists who took an enormous amount of data from the New York City criminal system. So hundreds of thousands of bail hearings. And use artificial intelligence to make a determination of whether the suspect would commit a crime if they were let out on jail. And they compared how good the AI was at making that judgment. They compared that with judges, human judges. The question is, who's better, man or machine? It turns out the computer is way better. I mean, it's not even close. The difference is, in fact, is so large that it's disturbing.
What was the difference?
Basically, it's 25%. So if the computer was to release the same number of defendants as the judges, the computer's defendants would commit 25% fewer crimes than the judges did.
And the computer had obviously never seen anyone.
This is what's interesting. The computers do a much better job than the judges, even though the computers have less information. All the AI system has is their record, their age, where they live, and the crimes they've committed. The judge has way more information. Principally, what the judge has is their record plus the evidence of their eyes. They're sitting in the courtroom, the defendant is in front of them, and they make a determination based on the criminal's appearance, demeanor, self-presentation, what they're saying, whether they're listening. I could go on, a million things, which suggests that the information that the judge gathers from the face-to-face encounter does not help them. It hurts them.
The other aspect of this that you talk about why we're inherently bad at reading people is this default to truth,
yes,
that we inherently believe that people are honest.
Yes.
And that is why we don't read them when they're being dishonest, when they're lying.
Yes. So this is the first and in some ways the most important argument in the book. And it comes from the work of this brilliant psychologist, Tim Levine. The puzzle for years and years and years has been, if you give any kind of test to people about their ability to detect deception. So suppose I showed you 100 videos of people, and I know in advance that 50% of those videos are of people lying, and then I show the videos to you and I say, pick the liars for me. You will get about 51 or 2% of the answers correct. You'll do slightly better than chance. And you are not alone, everyone. And for years, psychologists have been puzzling over why is this. Levine came along and said, we've misunderstood this. It is not the case that we're just blindly guessing. We're simply guessing that people are telling the truth over and over again, except in those very, very small number of cases where someone is a really, 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 really bad liar.
I found this such an interesting theory to posit from someone who is a journalist, because I feel as a journalist, and I think a lot of journalists would say this, and I talked about this with my colleagues before I came to meet with you, that it feels really subjective to say, oh, well, people just can't tell a liar because we see the good in people. I just don't believe people do see the good and the honest in people that much.
It's not seeing the good and honest. It is that from an evolutionary standpoint, we have evolved to instinctively accept the truthfulness of communication. So you and I could not have a conversation right now if both of us did not engage in default to truth. Every time I say a sentence, you don't stop and say, wait a minute, is he lying to me? No, we couldn't have a conversation. In fact, no human communication could be possible if this was the case. You wouldn't send your child to nursery school unless you defaulted to truth. If you assumed that every nursery school teacher was potentially a pedophile, you would not let your child out of the house until you had hired a private detective to scrutinize the backgrounds of everyone in the nursery school. And not just the nursery school, every sports coach, every doctor your child sees, I could go on and on and on. This society doesn't work unless we have as our default the presumption that truth is being told.
I was thinking about it in the context of, I was on holiday a few weeks ago and a friend and I were walking up a road. It was really hot. We had a lot of shopping and a guy stopped in his car and said, would you like a lift? And I really wanted a lift because I was really tired and it was hot and I had my shopping. But I said no, because I didn't want to get in his car, because that to me read like a situation that might not end well between strangers. Now, is that just me reacting to what I think I know about codes and people? Yes, probably. But also it's me not believing that what he was saying was completely the truth about just wanting to offer me a lift.
Well, I would suspect that that has very little to do with your determination of the character of the person who offered you a lift, and more to do with you adhering to a common sense principle. So one of the reasons we adhere to common sense principles about dealing with strangers is because we know we're so bad at detecting deception. So once you accept the fact that, you know what, human beings are terrible at figuring out whether they're dealing with a psychopath or just a lovely neighbor, what's the rational way around that? It is not to try and change our character and turn ourselves into suspicious monsters. It's just to have a couple of common sense principles. We tell children, don't take candy from strangers. Not because we think all strangers are evil, but just as like, it's a good common sense principle. It's not worth it. You don't need the candy. And if you're a young woman walking down a street with a lot of heavy bags and someone offers you a ride, it's a good common sense principle probably to say no, right?
I regretted it afterwards, Malcolm. I was very tired.
Oh, I see.
Yes, very tired.
But that's actually an accommodation of the very thing I'm talking about. It's not a reputation of it.
The other thing you speak about in the book is the way that alcohol interferes with stranger interactions. And you talk about that in the context of, a lot of people have known the Stanford rape case, the case of a guy called Brock Turner, who was found guilty of sexual assault of a young woman known as Emily Doe.
Good evening. Thanks for joining us. It was yet another campus sexual assault. A former Stanford swimmer convicted of three felonies after attacking an unconscious young woman. But it was his six-month sentence that provoked national outrage. Now, after serving just half his jail term, he's free.
They were both drunk at a party. And you talk about how we need to understand the impact of alcohol in these situations, because it would be wrong to separate them. Was that something you felt about that case, that alcohol wasn't something that was taken into account?
Yes. If you read, particularly in the American press, accounts, not just of that case, but accounts of all of these, and by the way, sexual assault cases on university campuses in the United States, and I'm sure in England as well, are extraordinarily common, depressingly, staggeringly, heartbreakingly common. But when you look at the way we discuss why are these cases happening with such devastating frequency, at least in America, the topic of alcohol rarely comes up. There was a best-selling book that came out 2 years ago in America on the problem of campus sexual assault, which essentially never mentions the word alcohol, which I read that and was astonished, because overwhelmingly these cases involve alcohol. It is, in fact, really, really, really hard to find a serious sexual assault case that does not involve quite dramatic impairment on the part of either one or both of the parties. Does this say that these cases are only about alcohol? No. What they say is that alcohol is a powerful component of what turns typically young men into people capable of criminal behaviour.
It's a complex issue, isn't it? And I'm sure you know from, you know, entering this debate, it's too simplistic to say that alcohol is the reason that men rape women. You describe, obviously, alcohol as affecting this interaction between two strangers. But why is it that as soon as these two people got drunk, one of those people decided to sexually assault the other? That wasn't just because he was drunk. That was, there's many other factors there.
No, that's why I say it's one of the accelerants. But one of the things I do in the chapter is describe a lot of relatively recent work that's been done that tries to figure out what exactly are the cognitive consequences of severe inebriation. We used to think drunkenness was disinhibition. What you're seeing when you see me drunk is the true Malcolm, right? Malcolm without all of this kind of baggage. Now we realize that's fundamentally wrong, that what drunkenness actually is myopia, that drunkenness destroys our ability to engage in higher order cognitive processing. It makes it impossible for us to see beyond what is immediately in front of us. We stop thinking about tomorrow. We stop thinking about long-term consequences. We stop thinking about anyone other than the person right in front of us. And when you think about that, that myopic Malcolm is not pure distilled Malcolm. Myopic Malcolm is not Malcolm at all. When I remove from a rational human being the ability to be rational, it's not them anymore.
Does that defend rape, though?
No, God, to the contrary. I think it clarifies lines of understanding. In other words, what I think this argument does is it permanently disables the use of drunkenness as an excuse, because now we're saying to people who get very, very drunk that you chose to engage in a behavior which dramatically increased your chances of engaging in a criminal act. You are as responsible for the consequences of what you did as a drunken driver is for hitting someone down the road, or anyone who chooses to dramatically transform their ability to behave in a civilized manner. And I strongly believe that until young people curb the worst excesses of their drinking, we're going to see sexual assault cases continue at their current epidemic levels.
Malcolm, thank you very much for speaking to me. It's been fascinating.
Thank you so much.
Talking to Strangers by Malcolm Gladwell is published in the UK on the 10th of September. Coming up, how Europe views the political fallout in Westminster. Now, it's the end of a week in politics that will be hard to forget, but after hours of late-night votes, sackings and some tears, we're still no closer to knowing how the UK will eventually leave the European Union. The Guardian's Brussels bureau chief, Daniel Boffey, explains how this is all being viewed by our negotiating partners in the EU.
It used to be the case that parliamentary antics in Westminster would cause a bit of excitement in Brussels and they'd watch on agog what was going on. But this week's developments, I sense some weariness among the diplomats and officials who are involved intimately in Brexit. They've gone through all this several times, and as dramatic as it is, they want rid of this problem now. The volatility, however, means that they can only assume the very worst. And so they've been upping their no-deal preparations. They have looked at releasing some €780 million that would usually be spent on natural disasters, flooding and fires and earthquakes. And they're looking at spending that on helping member states who would be most badly affected by a no-deal Brexit. That's all they can assume, because a lot of the people here, as intelligent as they are and well-versed in politics, the antics in Westminster are very, very difficult to understand. I mean, one said to me, I have a PhD in astrophysics, and that was rather simpler than to understand the protocols and procedures of the House of Commons. Boris Johnson's rejection of his 21 MPs, most of them extremely experienced, some of them very well-known politicians in Brussels, that expulsion, it's not gone down very well in Brussels, in that they look across the global picture and they see the Brazilian president, they see the American president, and they increasingly lump Boris Johnson in with that lot, with the populists. There are talks, though. I don't think it'd be accurate to say everything that's going on is a sham in Brussels, as Dominic Cummings allegedly had said. The talks essentially, though, are about the new UK government laying out its position, saying what they don't want on the Irish backstop, which is the device that would come into play to stop a hard border in the island of Ireland in the event of a Brexit, and saying what they don't want in the political declaration, which is the non-binding agreement between the UK and the EU about the future relationship.
The British position is to say we don't want the backstop and we don't want the backstop. Counter-proposal? Nothing. So basically they say, come back with something that pleases us. That's not a negotiation.
There is, as far as I can see, absolutely no possibility of renegotiating the backstop to meet his demands by the 31st of October. I say that not least because he's failed to come up with any actual proposals, and you can't imagine any proposals that he could come up with that would meet any of the criteria that the European Commission have for an insurance policy that will ensure there won't be a hard border on the island of Ireland under any circumstances. So given that, I think Boris Johnson probably knows that there's little chance of that. So in that sense, maybe it is a sham. A key part of what is now happening and what will happen on the 31st of October is the blame game. If we get to the point where Britain's sort of looking in danger of crashing out, then who gets the blame is important. The European Union will do everything it can not to get the blame for Britain crashing out, and therefore I think it will be highly likely to offer an extension, even if there isn't a request. There's no legal requirement for an extension request to be put forward. The only important thing is that a British head of state or government agrees. However, in reality, it's extremely unlikely that the European Union would want to deal solely with the Parliament. They like to deal with governments, with executives, and they will take their lead from whoever is the Prime Minister at the time.
That's it for today. Thank you to Malcolm Gladwell and Daniel Boffey. You can read all of his reporting at theguardian.com. Today's programme was produced by Joshua Kelly and Gary Marshall. Sound design was by Ian Chambers. And the executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. Have a good weekend. We'll be back on Monday.